Well, looks like it wasn't robbery they were after, Tom said uneasily. If it wasn't for the footsteps, you could almost think it was just a faulty lock.
But there were the footsteps. There undeniably were.
Think we should call the police? He asked.
We can't, can we? Nina said acidly. No landline and no bloody reception.
You had a couple of bars yesterday, I reminded her, but she shook her head.
Must have been a blip. I've had nothing since.
Well, look on the bright side. There's no smell of petrol, so with luck, it's not the crazed locals with their jerry cans come back for a second bonfire.
There was a silence.
Nobody laughed.
We should go back to bed, try to get some sleep, Claire said at last. We all nodded.
Want to pull your mattress in with us? Nina said unexpectedly to Tom. I wouldn't want to be by myself.
Thanks, Tom said. That's very kind, but I'll be fine. I'll lock my door just in case anyone's after my virtue. Not that I've got much left.
That was nice, I said to Nina after we had said goodnight to Tom and Claire and were huddled up in our own beds.
What you said to Tom, I mean.
Nice schmice. I felt sorry for the poor guy. Plus, he looks like he'd have a mean right hook if anyone did break in.
She sighed and then rolled over.
Want me to leave the light on?
No, it's okay.
That door's locked now. That's the main thing.
Fair enough.
She clicked off the light and I saw the glow of her phone.
Gone too? Bloody hell. And still not a single bar of reception.
How about you? Got anything?
I reached for my phone. It wasn't there. Hang on, I need to put the light on. I can't find it. I flicked the switch and looked around, beneath the bed, beneath the bedside table, then inside my bag. No phone. No phone anywhere, in fact. Just the unhooked charger trailing across the floor. I tried to remember when I'd last had it. In the car, maybe? I remembered using it at lunchtime, but after that I couldn't be sure. I'd got out of the habit of checking it here. With no reception, it seemed pointless. I thought I remembered taking it up here to charge it before supper, but maybe that was Friday. Most likely it had slipped out of my pocket in the car.
It's not here, I said. I think I must have left it in the car.
Never mind, Nina said. She yawned.
Just remember to find it tomorrow before we leave, yeah?
All right. Night.
Good night.
There was a rustle of duvet as she huddled down. I closed my eyes. I tried to sleep. What happened next? Oh, God. What happened next? I'm not sure I can... I am still sitting there, trying to put my confused tumble of thoughts in order, when the door swings wide and the nurse comes back in, pushing a trolley.
The doctor wants to have a wee look at his scans, but he says very likely you can have a bath after that. And I've got some breakfast for you here.
Listen, I try to sit up against the slipping, shifting pillows. Listen, the police outside the door, are they here for me?
She looks uncomfortable, and her gaze slides off to the small square of glass as she sets out Rice Krispies in a little carton, a jug of milk and a single clementine.
They're investigating the accident, she says at last.
I'm sure they'll want to speak to you, but the doctor has to sign you off. I've told them they're not barging into a hospital ward at this hour. They'll have to wait.
I heard... I swallow, hard, my throat hurting as if something is trying to escape, a sob or a scream. I heard them say something about a... death.
Ugh.
She looks annoyed, banging the locker drawer shut with unnecessary force.
You shouldn't be worrying you with your poor head.
But it's true. Someone died.
I can't say about that. I can't discuss other patients.
Is it true?
I'll have to ask you to calm down,
she says, and spreads out her hands in a professionally soothing gesture that makes me want to scream.
It's not good for your head to be getting upset like this.
Upset? One of my friends is probably dead, and you're telling me I shouldn't be upset.
Who?
For God's sake, who? And why can't I remember? Why can't I remember what happened before the accident?
It's quite common, she says, her voice still in that soothing cadence, as if she's speaking to a small child or someone hard of understanding.
Following a head injury, it's to do with the way the brain transfers short-term to long-term memory. If something interrupts the process, you can lose a bit of time.
Oh, God, I must remember. I must remember what happened, because someone is dead, and the police are outside. They are going to come in and ask me, and how can I know? How can I know what I'm saying, what I'm revealing, if I don't know what happened? I see myself, running through the forest with the blood on my hands and on my face and on my clothes. Please, I say. And my voice is close to cracking, close to pleading, and I hate myself for being so weak and needy. Please, tell me, please help me, what's happened? What's happened to my friends? Why was I covered in such a lot of blood? My head wound wasn't that bad. Where did all the blood come from?
I don't know, she says softly, and there's real compassion in her voice this time. I don't know, pet. Let me get the doctor, and perhaps he can tell you more. In the meantime, I want you to eat some breakfast. You've got to keep your strength up, and the doctor will want to see an appetite.
And then she backs out of the door with the trolley in front of her, and the door swings shut. And I am alone with my plastic bowl of Rice Krispies popping and clicking away as they soak into sugary mush. I should get up. I should force my weak, woolly limbs to do their duty, and I should swing them out of bed and march into the corridor and demand answers from those police officers outside. But I don't. I just sit there, and tears roll down my face and drip off my chin into the Rice Krispies, and the smell of the clementine is heady and overripe, reminding me of something I cannot remember and cannot forget.
Please, I think, please. Pull yourself together, you stupid bitch. Get up. Find out what happened. Find out who's dead.
But I don't move. And not just because my head hurts and my legs hurt and my muscles feel like wet tissue. I don't move because I am afraid. Because I don't want to hear the name the police are going to say. And because I am afraid they are here for me.
Chapter 21. The brain doesn't remember well. It tells stories. It fills in the gaps and implants those fantasies as memories. I have to try to get the facts. But I don't know if I'm remembering what happened or what I want to have happened. I am a writer. I'm a professional liar. It's hard to know when to stop, you know? You see a gap in the narrative, you want to fill it with a reason, a motive, a plausible explanation. And the harder I push, the more the facts dissolve beneath my fingers. I know that I woke with a jump. I don't know what time it was, but it was still dark. Beside me, Nina was sitting up in her bed, her dark eyes wide and glittering.
"Did you hear that?"
she whispered. I nodded. Footsteps on the landing. A door opening very softly. My heart was beating in my throat as I pushed back the duvet and grabbed my dressing gown. I remembered the kitchen door swung wide, the footsteps in the snow. We should have checked the rest of the house. At the door, I stood listening for a second, and then opened it with infinite caution. Claire and Flo were standing outside, their eyes wide, faces bleached pale with fear. Flo was holding the gun.
"Did you hear something?"
I whispered as low as I could. Claire gave a single, sharp nod and pointed to the stairs, her finger stabbing downwards. I listened hard, trying to still my shaky breathing and thudding heart. There was a scratching sound, and then a clear, definite thunk, as of a door being softly closed. There was someone down there.
"Tom?"
I mouthed. But even as I did, his door opened a crack and his face peered out.
"Did you... that sound?"
he whispered. Claire gave a grim nod. This time it was no open door, no wind. This time we could all hear it. Clear footsteps. as someone made their way through the tiled kitchen, across the parquet floor of the hallway, and then the soft, definite creak of a foot on the first of the stairs. Somehow, we had drawn together into a little knot. I felt someone's hand scrabbling for mine. Flo was at the centre, the gun raised, though its muzzle was shaking badly. I put my free hand out to steady it. There was another creak on the stairs, and an indrawn breath from all of us. Then a figure rounded the newel post halfway up, silhouetted against the plate glass window that overlooked the forest. It was a man, a tall man. He was dressed in some kind of dark hoodie, and I couldn't see his face. He was looking down at his phone, the screen glowing ghost white in the darkness.
"Fuck off and leave us alone!"
Flo screamed, and the gun went off. There was a deafening, catastrophic bang, and the sound of shattering glass, and the gun kicked like a horse. I remember that, and I remember that people fell over. I remember that I looked up to see. It didn't make sense. The huge plate glass window shattered, the glass spattered outwards onto the snow, clattering onto the wooden stairs. I remember the man on the stairs gave one choking exclamation, more of shock than of pain, and then he fell all of a heap, thudding slowly down the stairs like a stuntman in a film. I don't know who turned on the lights, but they flooded the tall hallway with brightness that made me wince and cover my eyes. And I saw. I saw the pale frosted stairs splashed with blood, and the shattered window, and the long, slow smear of gore where the man's body had slithered down to the ground floor.
"Oh, my God," Flo whimpered. "The gun. The gun was loaded."
When the nurse comes back, I'm crying.
"What happened?"
I manage.
"Someone is dead. Please tell me who's dead."
"I can't tell you, love." She looks genuinely sorry. "I wish I could, but I can't. But I've brought Dr. Miller here to take a look at you."
"Good morning, Leonora,"
he says, coming across to the bed. His voice is soft, pitying. I want to punch him in his fucking compassion.
"I'm sorry we're a bit tearful today."
"Someone is dead," I say very clearly, trying to keep my breath even, keep myself from gulping and sobbing. "Someone is dead, and no one will tell me who. And the police are sitting outside. Why?"
"Let's not worry about that at the moment."
"I am worried," I shout. Heads in the corridor turn. The doctor puts out a soothing hand, patting my leg beneath the blanket in a way that makes me want to shudder. I am bruised. I am hurt. I am wearing a hospital gown that's open at the back, and I've lost my dignity along with everything else. "Do not fucking touch me, you patronizing asshole. I want to go home."
"Look," he says, "I understand that you're upset, and the police will hopefully have some answers for you, but I'd like to examine you, ensure that you're up to speaking to them, and I can only do that if you're calm. Do you understand, Leonora?"
I nod my head mutely, and then turn my face to the wall while he examines the dressing on my head, checks my pulse and blood pressure against the readings on the machine. I close my eyes, let the indignities fade away. I answer his questions. "My name is Leonora Shaw. I'm 26. Today is..." Here I have to be helped, but the nurse prompts me. "It's Sunday. I have not even been here 12 hours. In which case, it's the 16th of November. I think this counts as disorientation rather than memory loss. No, I have no nausea. My vision is fine, thanks. Yes, I am having trouble recovering some memories. There are some things that you shouldn't have to remember."
"Well, you seem to be doing remarkably well,"
Dr. Miller says at last. He hangs his stethoscope round his neck and puts his little torch back in his top pocket.
"All the observations overnight are fine, and your scan is very reassuring. The memory trouble is concerning me a little bit. It's quite typical to lose the few minutes before a collision, but it sounds like you're having trouble a little further back than that. Is that right?"
I nod reluctantly, thinking of the patchy staccato blasts of images that invaded my head throughout the night. The trees, the blood, the swinging headlights.
Well, you may find it starts coming back. Not all causes of memory trouble.
He avoids the word amnesia, I have noticed.
Are down to physical trauma. Some are more stress-related.
For the first time in a little while, I look up, meet his eyes directly. What do you mean?
Well, this is not my speciality, you understand. I work with the physical head trauma. But sometimes the brain suppresses events that we're not quite ready to deal with. I suppose it's a coping mechanism, if you will.
What kind of events?
My voice is hard. He smiles. His hand is back on my leg again. I resist the urge to flinch.
You've had a difficult time, Leonora. Now, is there anyone we can call? Anyone you would like to be with you? Your mother has been informed. I understand that she's in Australia. Is that right?
That's right.
Any other relations? Boyfriend? Partner?
No. Please. I swallow, but there is no sense in putting this off any longer. The agony of not knowing is becoming more painful. Please, I'd like to see the police now. He stands, looks at his chart.
I'm not convinced you're up to it, Leonora. We've already told them you're not fit to answer questions.
I'd like to see the police. They are the only people who will give me answers. I have to see them. I stare at him while he pretends to study the chart in front of him, making up his mind. At last, he lets out a breath, a long, frustrated half-sigh, and shoves the chart into the holder at the foot of the bed.
Very well. They're only to have half an hour at the most, nurse, and I don't want anything too stressful. If Miss Shaw starts to find the interview difficult...
Understood, the nurse says briskly. Dr. Miller puts out his hand, and I shake it, trying not to look at the scratches and blood on my arm. He turns to go.
Oh, wait, sorry,
I blurt out as he reaches the door.
Can I have a shower first?
I want to see the police, but I don't want to face them like this.
A bath,
Dr. Miller says, and gives a short nod.
You've got a dressing on your forehead which I'd prefer you not to disturb. If you keep your head above water, yes, you can have a bath.
And he turns to go. It takes a long time to unhook everything from the machine. There are sensors, needles, and the thick incontinence pad between my legs, which makes me hot and cold with shame as I swing my legs to the floor, feeling its bulk. Did I wet myself in the night? There's no sharp smell of urine, but I can't be sure. The nurse gives me her arm as I stand, and although I want to push her away, I find I'm pathetically grateful for it, and I lean on her harder than I want to admit as I hobble painfully to the bathroom. Inside, the light flickers on automatically, and the nurse runs a bath, then helps me with the tapes of my gown. I can do the rest myself, I say, cringing at the thought of undressing in front of even a professional stranger, but she shakes her head.
I can't let you get into the tub without a hand, I'm sorry. If you slip...
She doesn't finish, but I know what she's saying. Another bang on top of what's already happened to my head. I nod, step out of the hideous adult nappy. The nurse whisks it away before I can worry about whether it's soiled or not. And then I let the gown fall to the floor, shivering in my nakedness, even though the room is sweatingly hot. I smell, I realize to my shame. I smell of fear and sweat and blood. The nurse holds my hand as I step unsteadily into the bath, catching onto the grab rails as I lower myself into the scalding water. Too hot, the nurse says quickly as I let out a little gasp, but I shake my head. It's not too hot.
Nothing could be too hot. If I could sterilize myself with boiling water, I would.
At last, I'm lying back in the water, shivering with effort. Can I... I'd like to be alone, please, I say awkwardly.
The nurse sucks in her breath, and I can see her about to refuse.
And suddenly I can't bear it anymore. I can't bear their scrutiny and their kindness and their constant watch. Please, I say, more roughly than I meant. For God's sake, I won't drown in 6 inches of water. All right, she says, though there is reluctance in her tone. But don't even think about trying to get out. You ought to pull the cord and I'll come in and help you. All right. I don't want to admit defeat, but I know in my heart that I would not be safe getting out of that bath myself. The nurse goes, leaving the door just a crack ajar, and I close my eyes and sink into the steaming water, shutting out her watchful presence outside the door, shutting out the hospital smells and sounds and the buzz of the fluorescent light. As I lie in the bath, I run my hands down all the cuts and scrapes and bruises, feeling the small clots and scabs soften and dissolve beneath my palms. And I try to remember what set me running through the woods with blood on my hands. I try to remember, but I'm not sure if I can bear the truth. After the nurse has helped me out, I towel myself gently dry, looking at my familiar body with its unfamiliar tracing of cuts and stitches. There are slashes on my shins. There are deep, ragged scratches across the front of the bone, as if I'd run through brambles or barbed wire. There are cuts on my feet and hands from running barefoot over glass, from shielding my face from flying debris. Finally, I walk across to the mirror and swipe away the steam, and I see myself for the first time since the accident. I've never been the kind to turn people's heads. Not like Claire, whose beauty is hard to ignore, or Nina, who's spectacular in a lean Amazonian kind of way. But I was never a freak. Now, as I peer at myself in the steam-bleeding mirror, I realize that if I saw myself on the street, I would turn away, out of pity or horror. The dressing at my hairline doesn't help. It looks as if my brains are being barely held in place. And nor do the smaller cuts and scratches dappled across my cheekbones and forehead, but they're not the worst. The worst is my eyes. 2 dark bronze-coloured shiners that blossom out from the bridge of my nose, leaching in blackened circles beneath my lower lids before they fade to yellow across my cheekbones. The right one is spectacular, the left one less so. I look like I've been punched in the face repeatedly. But I am alive, and someone is not. It is that thought that makes me pull on the hospital gown, lace up the ties, and shuffle out to face the world.
Admiring your shiners, the nurse gives a comfortable laugh. Don't worry. They've done all the scans, you've no basilar fracture. You've just got a bang to the face, or two.
Basilar?
Type of skull fracture. It can be very nasty. But they ruled it out, so don't fret. Black eyes aren't uncommon following a car crash, but they'll clear up in a few days.
I'm ready, I say.
For the police.
Are you sure you're up to it, Hen? You don't have to.
I'm up to it, I say firmly.
I'm back in bed, sitting with a cup of what the nurse claimed was coffee, but unless the head trauma has damaged my taste perception, is not, when there is a knock on the door. I look up sharply, my heart thudding. Outside, smiling through the wire-hatched glass pane in the door, there is a policewoman. She's in her 40s, maybe, and she is incredibly striking, with the kind of sculpted looks you might see on a catwalk. It feels shockingly incongruous, but I don't know why. Why shouldn't police officers have the face of David Bowie's wife?
Come in,
I say. Don't stammer, fuck!
Hello.
She opens the door and comes into the room, still smiling. She has the slender greyhound frame of a long-distance runner.
I'm Detective Constable Lamar.
Her voice is warm and her vowels are plum-coloured.
How are you feeling today?
Better, thank you.
Better? Better than what?
I'm in hospital, in a gown with no back and 2 black eyes. I'm not sure how much worse it could get.
Then I correct myself. I've been unhooked from the machine and they've removed the nappy. Apparently I can be trusted to pee by myself. This is, indeed, better.
I've spoken to your doctors. They tell me you may be up to a few questions. But if it's too much, we can stop. Just say. Is that all right? I nod, and she says, last night. Can you tell me what you remember?
Nothing. I remember nothing.
It comes out harder and terser than I meant. To my horror, I feel a lump in my throat, and I swallow fiercely. I will not cry. I'm a grown woman, for fuck's sake, not some child who scraped her knee in the playground wailing for her daddy.
No, that's not true, she says, but not accusingly.
Her voice is the gently encouraging tone of a teacher or an older sibling.
Dr. Miller tells me that you're pretty clear about events leading up to the accident. Why don't you start at the beginning?
At the beginning? You don't want my childhood traumas and stuff, do you?
Maybe.
She sits on the foot of the bed, in defiance of hospital regulations.
If they're relevant to what happened.
I tell you what, why don't we start with some easy questions, just to warm up. What's your name? How about that? I manage a laugh, but not for the reasons she thinks. What is my name? I thought I knew who I was, who I had become. Now, after this weekend, I'm no longer sure.
Leonora Shaw, I say, but I go by Nora.
Very well then, Nora. And you're how old?
I know she must know all this already. Perhaps it's some sort of test to see how bad my memory really is.
26.
Now tell me, how did you end up here?
What, in the hospital?
In the hospital, here in Northumberland generally, really.
You haven't got a northern accent,
I say, irrelevantly.
I was born in Surrey,
she says. She gives me a small complicit smile to acknowledge that this is not quite procedure, that she should be asking questions, not answering them, but this is a little token of something. I can't quite work out what. An exchange. A piece of her for a piece of me. Except that makes me sound broken.
So, she resumes. How did you end up here, then?
It was...
I put my hand to my forehead. I want to rub it, but the dressing is in the way, and I'm afraid to dislodge it. The skin beneath is hot and itchy.
We were on a hen weekend, and she went to university here. Claire did, I mean, the hen. Listen, can I ask you something? Am I a suspect?
A suspect?
Her beautiful, rich voice makes music of the word, turning the chilly, spiky noun into a solfège exercise. Then she shakes her head.
Not at this stage of the investigation. We're still gathering information, but we aren't ruling anything out.
Translation, not a suspect, yet.
Now, tell me, what do you remember of last night?
She returns to the subject like a very beautiful, well-brought-up cat circling a mouse hole.
I want to go home.
The scab beneath the dressing tingles and tickles. I can't concentrate. Suddenly, out of the corner of my eye, I see the uneaten clementine sitting on the locker, and I have to look away.
I remember.
I blink, and to my horror, I feel my eyes fill with tears.
I remember.
I swallow fiercely, and I dig my nails into my torn and bloody palms, letting the pain drive out the memory of him lying on the honey-coloured parquet bleeding into my arms.
Please. Please tell me who.
I stop. I can't say it. I can't. I try again.
Is.
The word chokes in my throat. I shut my eyes, count to 10. Dig my nails into the cuts on my palm until my whole arm is shaky with pain. I hear an exhalation from DC Lamar, and when I open my eyes, she looks, for the first time, worried.
We would like to get your side of the story before we muddy the waters, she says at last.
But her face is troubled, and I know what it is she is not allowed to say.
It's all right, I manage.
Something is coming apart inside me, breaking up.
You don't need to tell me.
Oh, God! And then I cannot speak. The tears come and come and come. It's what I feared. It's what I knew. Nora, I hear from Lamar, and I shake my head. My eyes are shut tight, but I feel the tears running down my nose and stinging the cuts on my face. She gives a small, wordless sound of sympathy, and then she stands. I'll give you a moment, she says, and I hear the door of the room creak open and then flap shut, swinging on its double hinges. I am alone, and I cry and cry until there are no tears left.
Chapter 22. I ran down the stairs as quickly as I could, trying not to cut my feet on the glass, holding onto the banister so as not to slip in the wetness from the man's blood. And there he was, curled in a small, pathetic heap at the bottom of the stairs. He was alive. I could hear his soft whimpers as he struggled to breathe.
Nina, I bellowed. Nina, get down here. He's alive. Someone dial 999. There's no fucking signal, Nina shouted back as she scrambled down the stairs.
Leo?
The man whispered, and my heart froze. And then he raised his face from his painful hunch, and I knew. I remember that moment with complete, heart-stopping clarity.
James?
It was Nina who spoke first, not me. She slipped rather than walked down the last few stairs, landing in a heap beside us on the floor, and her voice cracked as she gently felt for his pulse.
James? What the fuck are you doing here? Oh, my God!
She was almost crying, but her hands were doing their automatic work, checking where the blood was coming from, checking his pulse.
James, talk to me, she said. Nora, keep him talking. Keep him awake.
James? I didn't know what to say. We hadn't spoken for 10 years, and now...
James! Oh, my God! James! Why? How?
he said, and he coughed, blood flecking his lips.
Leo?
It sounded like a question, but I didn't know what he meant. Tell Leo? I only shook my head. There was so much blood. Nina had his hoodie unzipped, and she had found scissors from somewhere and was ripping up his T-shirt. I almost shut my eyes at the sight of his body, that skin that I had kissed and touched, every inch spattered with blood and shot wounds.
Oh, fuck, Nina moaned. We need an ambulance.
Did...
James was trying to speak in spite of the blood bubbling at his lips.
Did she... tell you...
about the wedding?
He's got a punctured lung. He's probably bleeding internally. Press on this.
Nina guided my hand to a pad of torn-up T-shirt pressed against James's thigh, from where blood was pumping frighteningly fast.
What can we do?
I was trying not to cry.
For the moment, try to stop him bleeding out. If that artery keeps going like that, he's dead no matter what. Press harder. It's still bleeding. I'll try a tourniquet, but...
Oh, my God! It was Flo. She looked like a ghost standing there, her hands over her face.
Oh, my God! I'm so sorry. I can't deal with the blood.
She gave a little gasping sigh and collapsed, and I heard Nina swear under her breath, long and low.
Tom, she bellowed. Get Flo away from here. She's fainted. Get her to her room.
She pushed the hair back from her face. There was blood on her cheekbone and on her brow.
Claire,
James said. He licked his lips. His eyes were fixed on mine like there was something he was trying to tell me. I squeezed his hand, trying to hold it together.
She's coming.
Where the hell was she?
Claire!
I shouted. No answer.
No,
James managed.
Claire, text. Did she say?
His voice was so faint it was hard to work out what he was trying to say.
What?
He had closed his eyes. His hand in mine was relaxing.
He's dying,
I said to Nina, hearing the hysteria rising in my own voice.
Nina, do something! What the fuck do you think I am doing? Playing tea parties? Get me a towel. No, wait. Don't let go of that pad on his thigh. I'll get it. Where the fuck is Claire?
She got up and ran for the kitchen, and I heard her banging through drawers. James lay very still.
James?
I said, suddenly panicked.
James, stay with me.
He opened his eyes, painfully, and lay looking up at me, his eyes bright and dark in the soft light from the hall. His T-shirt was split open like a peeled fruit, and his blood-stained chest and belly were bare to the cold air. I wanted to touch him, to kiss him, to tell him everything was okay, but I could not, because it was a lie. I gritted my teeth and pressed harder on the pad on his thigh, willing the blood to stop pooling and pooling.
I'm sorry,
he said, very faint, so faint that I thought I had misheard.
What?
I put my head closer, trying to hear.
I'm sorry.
His hand squeezed mine, and then, to my astonishment, he reached up, his arm trembling with the effort, and touched my cheek. His breath rattled in his throat, and a thin trickle of blood came from the corner of his mouth. I squeezed my eyes shut, trying not to cry.
Don't be silly, I managed. It was a long time ago. It's all over now.
Claire?
Oh, fuck, where was she? A tear dripped off my nose onto his chest, and he reached up again and tried to wipe my cheek, but his arm was too weak and he let it fall back.
Don't cry.
Oh, James!
It was all I could manage, the gulping exhortation that tried to say everything I couldn't.
James, don't die. Please, don't die.
Leo,
he said softly, and he closed his eyes. Only James ever called me that. Only him. Always him. I am still crying when the knock on the door comes, and I struggle up against the pillows before remembering the electric button that raises the bedhead automatically. The bed grinds me into a sitting position, and I take a deep, shuddering breath and swipe at my eyes. Come in. The door opens, and it is Lamar. I know my eyes must be red and wet, and my throat croaky, but I can't find it in myself to care.
Tell me the truth,
I say, before she can say anything else, before she sat down even.
Please, I'll tell you everything I can remember, but I have to know.
Is he dead?
I'm sorry,
she says, and I know. I try to speak, but I can't. I sit, shaking my head and trying to make the words come, but they don't. Lamar sits in silence while I struggle for control. And then, at last, when my breathing eases, she holds out the paper tray she's carrying.
Coffee?
She asks, gently.
I shouldn't care.
James is dead. What does coffee matter? I nod, half reluctantly, and when she hands it to me, I take a long sip. It's hot and strong. It is as unlike the watery hospital gravy as chalk from Gorgonzola, and I feel it running into every cell of my body and waking me up. It is impossible to believe that I can be alive, and James can be dead. When I put the cup down, my face feels stiff and my head aches.
Thank you,
I manage, my voice rough. Lamar leans across the gap between us and squeezes my hand.
It was the least I could do. I'm sorry. I didn't want you to find out like that, but I was asked.
She stops and rephrases.
It was thought advisable not to tell you more than you knew already. We wanted to get your version, uninfluenced.
I don't say anything. I just bow my head. I have written about this kind of thing, this kind of interview, all my adult life, and I never imagined for one moment I would be here.
I know this will be painful, she says at last, as the silence stretches. But please, can you think back to last night? What do you remember?
I remember up to the shooting, I say.
I remember running down the stairs and seeing him lying there. I grit my teeth and pause for a moment, the breath hissing between my teeth. I will not cry again. Instead, I gulp at the coffee, not caring that it scalds as I swallow. "You must know about the shooting," I say at last. "Did they tell you, the others? Nina and Claire and everyone?"
"We have several different accounts," she says, a hint of evasiveness in her voice. "But we need to get all the perspectives."
"We were scared," I say, trying to think back. It seems like 100 years ago, swathed in a fog of adrenaline as we all crept round the house, half hysterical with a mixture of drunken excitement and genuine fear. "There was a message on the Ouija board about a murderer." The irony, as I say it, is almost unbearable. "We didn't believe it, most of us, anyway, but I suppose it made us edgy. And there were footprints in the snow outside, and when we woke up, the first time, I mean, the kitchen door had come open."
"How?"
"I don't know. Someone had locked it, or said they had. Flo, I think. Or was it Claire? Someone had checked, anyway. But it blew open, and it just made us all more crazed and frightened. And so when we heard the footsteps..."
"Whose idea was it to get the gun?"
"I don't know. Flo had it from earlier, I think, from when the door blew open. But it wasn't supposed to be loaded. It was supposed to have blanks."
"And you were holding it, is that right?"
"Me?"
I looked up at her with genuine shock.
"No. It was Flo, I think. It was definitely her."
"But your fingerprints are on the barrel." "They have fingerprinted the gun?" I stare at her. Then I realize she's waiting for an answer.
"On the barrel, yes. Fuck, do not stammer. But not on the other bit, the handle bit. The stock, I mean. Look, she was waving it around like a crazy thing. I was trying to keep it away from us."
"Why, if you thought it wasn't loaded?" The question takes me aback. Suddenly, in spite of the sun, the room feels cold.
I want to ask again if I'm a suspect, but she has said I'm not, and won't it look strange to keep asking? Because I don't like having a gun pointed at me, no matter what it's loaded with. All right?"
"All right,"
she says mildly, and makes a note on her pad. She flips over a sheet and then turns back. "Let's go back a bit. James, how did you know him?" I shut my eyes. I bite the inside of my cheek to keep from crying. There are so many options open to me. We went to school together. We were friends. He is Claire's fiancé. Was, I correct myself silently. It is impossible to believe he is gone. And I realize, suddenly, the selfishness of my grief. I have been thinking about James, but Claire has lost everything. Yesterday she was to be a bride. Today she is, what? There's not even a word for what she is. Not a widow, just bereft. We used to be together, I say at last. It's better to be honest, surely, or at least as honest as I can be.
When did you break up?
A long time ago. We were, 16 or 17. The O is a little dishonest. It makes it sound like a guesstimate. In fact, I know to the day when we broke up. I was 16 and 2 months. James was just a few months away from his 17th birthday.
Amicably?
Not at the time, no.
But you've made up since. I mean, you were on Claire's hen weekend.
She trails off, inviting me to jump in with platitudes about how time heals everything, how betrayals at 16 are the stuff you laugh about at 26. Only I don't. What should I say?
The truth?
Something cold is stealing around my heart, a chill in spite of the hospital heat and the warmth of the setting sun. I don't like these questions. James's death was an accident, a gun that should never have been loaded, going off by mistake. So why is this policewoman here, asking about long-dead breakups? What relevance does this have to James's death? I say abruptly, too abruptly. Her head comes up from her notepad, her plum-coloured lips forming a silent oh of surprise. Damn. Damn, damn, damn. We're just trying to form a complete picture, she says mildly. I feel cold all up and down my spine. James was shot by a gun that was supposed to be unloaded. So who loaded it? I feel the blood drain from my cheeks. I very, very much want to ask the question I asked before. Am I a suspect? But I can't. I can't ask, because to ask would be suspicious. And suddenly, I very much want to not be suspicious. It was a long time ago, I say, trying to recover. It hurt a lot at the time, but you get over things, don't you? No, you don't. Not things like that. Or at least, I don't. But she doesn't hear the lie in my voice. Instead, she smoothly changes tack. What happened after James was shot? She asks. Can you remember what you all did next? I shut my eyes. Try to walk me through it, she says. Her voice is soft, encouraging, almost hypnotic. You were with him in the hallway? I was with him in the hallway. There was blood on my hands, on my nightclothes. His blood. Masses of it. His eyes had drifted closed, and after a few minutes I put my face down to his, trying to hear if he was still breathing. He was. I could feel his halting breath on my cheek. How different he was to when we had been together. There were lines around his eyes, a 5 o'clock shadow on his jaw, and his face had become leaner and more defined. But he was still James. I knew the contours of his brow, the ridge of his nose, the hollow beneath his lip where the sweat beaded on summer nights. He was still my James, except he was not. Where in God's name was Claire? I heard footsteps behind me, but it was Nina, holding a length of white cloth which looked like a sheet. She knelt and began binding James's leg very tight. I think our best hope is to stabilize you until we get you to hospital, she said very loud and clear, talking to James, but to me as well, I knew. James, can you hear me? He didn't respond. His face had gone a strange waxen colour. Nina shook her head and then said to me, Claire had better drive, you direct. I'll go in the back with James and try to keep him going until we get there. Tom had better stay with Flo, I think she's in shock. Where's Claire? She was trying to get a signal up the far end of the garden. Apparently you can sometimes get one there. But there's nothing. A voice came from over my shoulder. It was Claire. Her face was the colour of skimmed milk, but she was dressed. Can he talk? He was saying a few words, I said. My throat was cracked and hoarse with tears. But I think he's unconscious now. Oh, fuck. Her face went even whiter, even her lips bloodless pale, and there were tears in her eyes. I should have come down sooner. I just thought...
Don't be silly, Nina cut her off. It was the right thing to do. Getting an ambulance was the most important thing. If we could only have got a fucking signal. Right. I think that tourniquet is as good as I can make it. I'm not going to try to do anything else now. Let's get him out of here.
I'll drive, Claire said instantly.
Nina nodded.
I'll come in the back with James.
She looked out of the window.
Claire, you go and bring the car as close to the front door as you can get it.
Claire nodded and left to get her car keys. Nina carried on, talking to me this time.
We'll need something to lift him on. It'll hurt him too much if we just pick him up.
What sort of thing?
Something flat, ideally, like a stretcher.
We both gazed around, but there was nothing obvious.
We could take a door down.
Tom's voice came from behind us, making us both jump.
He gazed down at James, now fully unconscious on the floor in a spreading pool of his own blood. There was a kind of horror in his expression.
Flo's out cold in the bedroom. Is he going to be okay?
Honestly, Nina said. She glanced at James, and I saw her face was weary and, for the first time since she had taken over, showing traces of fear.
Honestly, I don't know. It's possible he'll make it. Door's a good idea. Can you find a screwdriver? I think there was a box of stuff under the stairs.
Tom gave a short nod and disappeared. Nina put her face in her hands.
Fuck,
she said into her cupped, muffling palms.
Fuck, fuck, fuck.
Are you all right?
No.
Yes, she looked up.
I'm fine. Just... Oh, my God. What a fucking stupid, wasteful way to die. Who the hell fires a gun when they don't know what it's loaded with?
I thought of Tom, waving it around yesterday as a joke, and I felt suddenly sick. Poor Flo, I said.
Did she pull the trigger?
Nina asked.
I assume so. I don't know. She was holding it.
I thought you were.
Me?
I felt my jaw drop with surprise and horror.
God, no! But it could have been anyone who jolted her. We were all standing so close.
There was a growl from outside, and I heard Claire's tires crunching through the snowy gravel outside the front door. At the same time, there was a thud from the living room, and Tom appeared, dragging a heavy oak door with the handle still attached.
It weighs a ton, he said, but we've only got to get it as far as the car.
Okay. Nina took charge again, her authority effortless.
Tom, you take his shoulders, I'll take his feet. Nora, you support his hips as we lift and shift them onto the door. Try not to disturb that dressing on his thigh, and be careful not to catch anything on the door handle. Ready? On my count of lift, 3, 2, 1, lift.
We all heaved. There was a kind of groaning, involuntary whimper from James that brought a fresh spatter of blood to his lips, and then he was onto the makeshift stretcher. I ran to open the huge steel front door, thanking God for the first time for the scale of this house. The internal door would fit through easily, and then back to help Nina with the foot end of the door. It was immensely heavy, but we wrestled it down the hallway and out into the freezing night where Claire was waiting, the engine ticking over, the exhaust a white cloud in the cold air.
"Is he okay?"
she asked over her shoulder, reaching to open the rear door.
"Is he still breathing?"
"He's still breathing," Nina said. "But it'll be touch and go. Okay, let's get him off this door."
Somehow, in a horrible, trembling, blood-spattered rush, we got him into the back seat where he lay slumped, breathing in a shallow, rasping way that frightened me. His leg was hanging out of the car, and, grotesquely, I saw that the seeping blood was steaming in the chilly air. The sight stopped me in my tracks, and I was just standing there, too shocked to think what to do next, as Tom folded the leg gently into the footwell and then shut the door.
"There's not going to be enough room for both of us," Nina said.
For a minute, I didn't know what she was talking about, and then I realized. James was taking up all the back seat by himself. There was no way Nina could fit in the back as she'd suggested.
"I'll stay," I said. "You should go with them."
Nina didn't try to argue.
"Nora?"
Lamar's voice is gentle but insistent.
"Nora, are you awake? Can you tell me what you remember?"
I opened my eyes.
"We got James out to the car. We didn't have anything to carry him, so Tom took down a door. Claire was driving. Nina was supposed to go in the back seat with James, and I was going to direct."
"Supposed to?"
There was a misunderstanding. I'm not sure what happened. We got James into the car, and we realized there wasn't going to be room for all of us. I told Nina she should go with him, she's a doctor, and I'd stay. She agreed, and we ran back into the house to get her phone and blankets for the car. But something happened."
"Go on." I shut my eyes, trying to remember. The events are starting to blur together. I remember Claire gunning the engine and Tom calling something over his shoulder.
"Why not?"
Claire shouted back, and then, impatiently,
"Oh, never mind, I'll call when I get there."
And then there was the grinding sound of tires on gravel, and I saw the red of her taillights as she bumped off down the rutted track of the road.
What the fucking fuck?
Nina had shouted from upstairs. She skittered down the stairs and bellowed, Claire, what are you doing? But Claire was gone.
There was a misunderstanding, I say to Lamar. Tom said that he told Claire we were just coming, but Claire must have thought he said they're not coming. She started off without Nina.
And what next?
What next? But that's what I'm not sure of. I remember Claire's coat was hanging over the porch rail. She must have intended to take it and forgotten. I remember I picked it up. I remember Nina crying. I remember standing in the kitchen with my hands beneath the tap, watching James's blood run down the plug hole. And then, I don't know if it's the shock or what happened after, but things begin to fragment, and the harder I push, the more I'm not sure if I'm remembering what happened or what I think happened. I remember picking up Claire's jacket. Or was it Claire's? I have a sudden picture of Flo at the clay pigeon shoot wearing a similar black leather jacket. Was it Claire's or was it Flo's? I remember picking up the jacket. I remember the jacket. What is it about the jacket I can't remember? And then I'm running, running through the woods, desperate to stop them. Something started me running. Something had me shoving my feet into my cold trainers with panicked desperation and tumbling headlong down the narrow forest track, the torch swinging wild in my hand. But what? I look down. My fingers are cupped as though I'm trying to hold on to something small and hard. The truth, perhaps. I can't remember, I say to Lamar. This is when it starts to get really fuzzy. I can remember running through the trees. I stop, trying to piece it all together. I gaze up at the harsh strip light and then back down at my hands as if they can give me an inspiration. But my hands are empty.
We've got a statement from Tom, Lamar says at last. He says that you were holding something, looking down at it in your palm, and then you just took off, without even putting your coat on. What made you set off?
I don't know.
There is rank desperation in my voice.
I wish I did. I can't remember.
Please, try. It's very important.
I know it's important.
It comes out as a shout, shockingly loud in the small room. My fingers are clenched on the thin hospital blanket.
Do you think I don't know that? This is my friend, my...
I can't speak. I can't come up with a word for what James is to me, was to me. My knees are drawn up to my chest and I am panting, and I want to hit my head on my knees and keep on hitting until the memories bleed out, but I can't. I can't remember.
Nora?
Lamar says, and I'm not sure if her voice is trying to soothe or warn me. Perhaps both.
I want to remember.
My teeth are gritted.
More than you can believe.
I believe you,
Lamar says. There is something sad in her voice. I feel her hand on my shoulder, and then there's a bang at the door, and the nurse comes in, pushing a trolley.
What's going on here?
She looks from me to Lamar, taking in my tear-stained face and unconcealed distress, and her pleasant round face puckers in disapproval.
You, missy, I'll not have you upsetting my patients like this.
She stabs a finger at Lamar.
She's not 24 hours after nearly killing herself in a car crash. Out.
She didn't,
I try.
It wasn't...
But it's only partly true. Lamar has upset me, and in spite of my protest, I'm glad to see her go, glad to curl on my side under the sheets as the nurse dishes up cottage pie and limp green beans, muttering under her breath about the high-handedness of the police, and who do they think they are barging in here without so much as a by your leave, upsetting her patients, setting them back days, if not weeks. The school dinner smell fills the room as she plops and ladles and sets the tray down beside me.
Eat up now, pet, she says, with something close to tenderness. You're just skin and bone.
Rice Krispies are all very well, but they're no food to get well on. You need meat and veg for that.
I'm not hungry, but I nod.
When she's gone, though, I don't eat. I just lie on my side, holding my aching ribs, and try to make sense of it. I should have asked how Claire was, where she was,